Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It's a podcast double whammy. Strike up the band!
Well, obviously, I'm delighted to be considered cleverer than both of them.
I'd want Anton Deck.
You know, my man Jeremy, I dig what he says. I want Taylor Swift.
All right, keep it light, Peter.
Yeah, we're back again. It's How to Win an Election, your insider's guide to a huge political year. I'm Matt Chorley, joined as ever by new Labour mastermind Peter Mandelson. Polly McKenzie is Policy McKenzie, former Director of Policy for Nick Clegg, and Tory brain box Daniel Finkelstein. If you want to get in touch, if you've got questions, in fact, next week's episode is going to be all your questions. So if you want to get in touch, email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk or you can WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. Send us a voice note and you could hear yourself on next week's episode of the podcast. But let's focus on this week's. In a moment, we're going to talk about manifestos and who's writing them and what you should put in them and what you shouldn't. But Peter, you've been making news again. At the weekend, you wrote in the Sunday Times about Labour's plans for reforming workers' rights, including a ban on zero-hours jobs, and you warned against rushing them through. And then you've upset the unions. Unite General Secretary Sharon Graham said Peter Mandelson earns his corn working as a consultant for private corporations. His constant attack on workers' rights seems to be driven by personal financial interests, as well as his outdated desire to see Labour reduced to a 1990s neoliberal tribute act.
Wow.
Yeah.
God.
And as if you'd work for corn.
As if I'd work for corn. And then she had the General Secretary of the TUC coming in yesterday and backing her up. I mean, at one level, this is a... it's a ridiculous storm in a teacup. I mean, it's an argument about absolutely nothing at all, because I wrote in my article in the Sunday Times that I supported the case for reform and I backed it. And when I was describing what Labour was proposing in outline, I was quoting directly from Rachel Reeves. And when I said that it would be a good idea to sort of consult and bring the employers along, I was echoing everything that Keir Starmer has said to date. So why was I touching such a raw nerve? And I think it was because these people who spoke up against me think that, you know, once the movement has decided, you know, that's it. You know, we just sort of agree amongst ourselves, pass down what we want to do, and everyone has to go along with it. Now, my view is slightly different. Because if the Labour Party is constantly talking, as it is, about partnership with business, you can't sort of talk to them about everything in partnership except the thing that most directly affects them, which is labour market and trade union legislation. And if you're trying to create an economy in which you're giving security for working people, you're trying to create the chances of flexibility for people where they want it, you're trying to create mobility both for individuals and to make the economy go, you're going to have to look at rather more specific proposals. And there you've got to consult not just the trade unions, but the employers as well. And that was all I was saying, echoing, as I said, everything that Keir Starmer has said to date. But you'd have thought that, you know, Armageddon had arrived.
Well, can I just add another point about what she said, which is, don't quite a lot of people earn their corn from the private sector? Indeed.
Oh, that's a crime. That's a crime.
Indeed,
that's a crime
for
Sharon.
Most listeners do that. And it would be quite a good idea if we kind of grew a lot of corn and earned a lot of corn. And so this idea of sort of casually treating with contempt the fact that somebody might earn some corn from the private sector. How do you think we have a public sector if we don't have a private sector?
Yeah. There's another point also. The General Secretary of the TUC, when he came in yesterday, said, sort of sneered at me for being a member of the House of Lords. What does he know about, you know, working people and how much they should be paid? But, you know, apart from the fact that I actually signed into law the national minimum wage in this country in 1998 when I was Trade and Industry Secretary, I also introduced the legislation Fair Deal at Work, by the way, in 1998. And my first job when I came out of university was in the economic department of the TUC, no doubt before he was born. But here's the point. This legislation, which is going to be controversial, it always is, has got to get through the House of Lords.
Yeah.
And Labour peers are in a minority in the House of Lords. And therefore, we're going to have to persuade an awful lot of other parties, Liberal Democrats, a huge swathe of crossbench peers, you know, to give this legislation some goodwill and a fair wind. You know, saying that, you know, members of the House of Lords have got no right to express a view is not a really good place to start, in my view.
Should we talk about the policy?
No, I think we'll talk about corn.
I've never been paid in corn. I've always been paid in good old British pound sterling.
Good. No euro for you.
Oh, no. Of course not. So I remember Ed Miliband was against zero-hours contracts, and he used to talk about ending exploitative zero-hours contracts. I think you often hear this kind of linguistic trick from politicians. That is ambiguous. End exploitative zero-hours contracts. Sounds like you're going to end zero-hours contracts because they're exploitative. Actually, what he was proposing at the time, though I think it just said end zero-hours contracts on the Edstone in 2015, what he was proposing was a relatively sensible set of regulations to ensure that zero-hours contracts could not be used in exploitative ways. Actually, Vince Cable, during the coalition years, consulted on a bunch of proposals. There's been a number of reviews that set out a range of really sensible ways to regulate zero-hours contracts so that when they are being used for a really, really long time, you know, month after month, year after year, and the idea is you can just pull the rug from under somebody even though they've had regular working hours, that is an exploitative zero-hours contract. But I think politicians get into a bit of a mess when they overpromise and they make it sound like what we're going to do is get rid of them.
Because they're dealing with slogans. But Polly puts her finger on the nub of the issue. Angela Rayner made the point to me when we were talking about this a few weeks ago. There are different ways of abolishing or reforming zero-hours contracts. There is no single solution off the shelf, this is what you do and off you go. There are different ways of doing it. And indeed, the Low Pay Commission has looked at zero-hour contracts and concluded that you can't and shouldn't literally ban them. But you can introduce legislation that curbs the more egregious behaviour, exploitative behaviour, of employers. And that's what you've got to consult on.
But I suppose what this I won't call it a row, because obviously you're just having a public policy discussion. But
yes.
What this points to is the problem that Labour will have this year as they do finally start putting some flesh on the quite bare bones of what they're planning to do, and the competing demands of what might be popular with the public, what might be popular with Labour MPs, and what the unions will, you know, and that risks creating a row.
And we're going to talk about manifestos, right? And manifestos are often full of these quite clever phrases that could mean that you're banning all of something or just the exploitative kind. And it's then when you get into government that you actually have to unpick it and turn it into some legislation. And the ambiguity has to be eradicated. And that is when you can start around.
One of the things is, I mean, people obviously, they don't hear even the original promise. But even when they do hear that, they often don't hear and are not really supposed to hear the condition. So obviously that use of exploitative was pretty deliberate. I think Ed Miliband probably knew what he was doing and what he was conveying. And then politicians end in a position where people think they've promised something which they feel in good faith they didn't promise. Certainly the Conservative Party between 1992 and 1997, I think, suffered as a result of conveying to people that it wouldn't ever increased taxation when it was going to have to do so, and felt then, you know, annoyed because they hadn't actually said that, but they'd given that impression and people had taken that away.
It's called the weasel words approach to policy making and manifesto writing. And I think that certainly in an area of labour market and trade union law, which is so complex, an area, as I know from my own ministerial experience, some specificity is a good idea, not least because when you go into an election campaign, as we will, with these proposals, they're going to be weaponized against us by the Tory party and others. It would be better to have talked to the employer organizations before, got them into a position of sort of give and take on what we're proposing, at least got them into sort of a neutral over it, so that they can't then be levered onto the side of the Tories when they're busy attacking us. And that, I think, is a much better political approach by the Labour Party than simply saying, we've decided, the National Policy Forum has met, the movement has decided, and that's that.
Well, we'll come on to the details of manifestos in a minute. I also want to ask, Danny, as MPs pack up and head off for their Easter recess, is that a good thing because it stops them plotting in Westminster, or is it a bad thing because they go back and meet their constituents and find out they're even less popular than they thought?
Well, you can guess what my answer will be. I'm not sure it makes a huge amount of difference between those two things. It'll make a difference to what we write in, what lobby correspondents write, and, you know, the kind of noise in politics. And I suppose it does give, you know, on the whole, the leadership probably finds that a good period where they can develop their own narratives and stories and use it to try and set the agenda that they want to set and be subject to less not particularly helpful advice from people telling them what they should be doing. So generally speaking, it's probably helpful to leaderships at the margin. But in general, I'm not a believer that kind of political gossip is that central in the outcome of any election.
I think it will be the local elections that provide a trigger point for people to potentially change their mind on one side or the other of this debate. And 2 weeks of gossiping with their constituents or 2 weeks of gossiping with their colleagues in the tea room in Westminster probably don't make a difference either way until you get that kind of the trigger point of probably quite disastrous results in the elections.
I bumped into a Tory MP yesterday and I wished him a happy recess. I said, you know, hope that your rendezvous with the voters goes well, ha ha. And he said, we're going to be spending our time, he said, burnishing our CVs and buffing up our interview suits, he said, looking forward to the election.
Buffing a suit? How do you buff a suit?
You'd end up being shiny, wouldn't you? You don't want a shiny suit.
Well, just passing on.
We won't ask you to do any more fashion advice, but you know,
I mean, let's get off image ties and the rest for being there, done that.
Did you suggest he lose weight?
Got the T-shirt, thank you very much. I did no such thing. But the truth is that you can feel a little bit sorry for Rishi Sunak, only a little bit. I mean, he's got good message discipline now. He goes on about his plan the whole time. We've got the plan, don't end the plan, don't abandon the plan, see the plan through, whatever the plan is. He is going everywhere in the country, helicoptering into different target seats and regions in order to meet people with his sort of slightly overly well-rehearsed soundbites, you know, rather worthy soundbites, earnest soundbites. But everything he does, he just encounters his party. And they just seem determined to lose the election because so many of them have lost faith in their ability to win it. And they just seem to want to give him as bad and hard a time as they possibly can. It's almost unfair.
Do you feel sorry for him, Polly?
I think he can afford a new suit for his job interviews after being Prime Minister. You know, I mean, of course...
Was that who you were speaking to? Is the Prime Minister buffing his suits?
But on the human perspective, of course, but, you know, you don't go into this life of politics without kind of the expectation that it's going to be difficult. I think that the vibe that you get from Rishi Sunak of feeling a little bit resentful about the fact that it's hard being Prime Minister, I don't have a lot of sympathy for that. And I But I do think that this context that the Conservative Party has created around him is incredibly difficult. They're basically having a sort of collective panic attack. They need to go through some mindfulness exercises and think about, you know, like what's actually in front of them. The strategy, as Peter describes it, is the best strategy available to them, which is to say that the plan is working and people should stick with the plan. That is almost certainly not a winning strategy. But it doesn't mean it's not the best strategy for minimising their losses. The problem is nobody can really come to terms with the idea that they might lose. And so they're casting around harming the strategy with, you know, just this kind of collective panic attack.
Well, we're just on strategy and what's happened in the last week. And since we last met, we've had another Ed Davey stunt.
It was a really bad one. Like, I don't know what's happened to the props budget, but so at my real job at the University of the Arts, we have whole courses in prop making and set design, and honestly, we could have done him a better job. It was this sort of like, oh, practically
an hourglass,
practically a 2D hourglass.
Yeah,
right.
So like, if you hadn't seen, so previously he's done the clock because it was time up for Rishi Sunak.
There was a door,
the door show Boris Johnson, the door or Rishi Sunak. There was a cannon, get the clowns out, and so they've gone back. They've basically run out of puns. They've gone back to the time, and so it was an hourglass. But the trouble was because I think it was said time's up, Rishi Sunak or something. Tell Rishi time's up. But it ended up at one point because the grain, it wasn't even sand, was coming out. It was so slowly. It's, like I said, time up Trish.
Sounds great.
It was a low quality prop. I mean, yeah. I think somebody needs to make some donations to the Liberal Democrats simply to support the quality of their prop making.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. All Ed Davey needs to do is release the Nick Clegg recreating the Carly Rae Jepsen music video.
I've never seen it, Matt.
You've never seen it?
I've never seen it.
Do you know about this, Peter?
I don't know.
There's a music video for a young pop star called Carly Rae Jepsen, which starred Tom Hanks. And in 2015, Nick Clegg filmed a shot-by-shot recreation of it in the hope that he would go viral. And it cost about £8,000 and they never released it. That's how bad it was.
Wow.
Yeah.
The song is Sorry, right?
No, the song is I Really Like You.
Oh.
So the hope was that people would say, I really like that, Nick Clegg. Look at him walking around Gravesend pretending to be Tom Hanks.
8,000 is
pretending to be Carly Rae Jepsen.
8,000 is a lot of money in Liberal Democrat terms.
It's pretty cheap for
thinking,
a film.
Yeah, I was thinking that's a complete bargain. I don't know how they managed to do it for 8,000. Well, I've made worse political videos, I think, for much more money than that.
Of course, the worst political video, I think, of all time now is the video that the Conservative Party released yesterday of scaremongering about crime in London, which has the production values of an Ed Wood movie and includes a clip of Penn Station in New York.
People chaos on the streets of London, but actually it's a clip of Penn Station.
And then they re-released it with sort of weird stock footage of an office worker looking stressed instead of Penn Station. I mean, honestly, probably the worst video ever made.
There's a whole podcast of that, I think.
Like, zooms out space and then zooms back in again. It's voiced over by an American. I thought we're supposed to be patriotic in the Conservative Party.
I don't get it.
Like, Fitz the Bulldog, that was the best election. Do you remember Fitz?
No, we're not talking about testicles again.
We'll come back.
Do you remember?
Yes, you have told us a story.
Didn't we talk about his bits?
Yes. Yeah, you photoshopped them out. Good. Right, up next we will talk about manifestos. I think we'll come back and we'll do terrible adverts another week. Up next we're going to talk about manifestos. What should you put in them and what shouldn't you? That's next on How to Win an Election.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey.
If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, joined by our political masterminds, Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. So, MPs clearing off for the Easter recess, but work will be beginning on party manifestos. And we've had this question in from a How to Win an Election listener.
Hello, How to Win team. I was just wondering what the process was of putting together a manifesto in your political parties. Who writes it and who approves it? Loving the podcast, Charlie.
That's Charlie there. So, manifestos, who writes them, who approves them? When does this process begin? Is it happening already, Danny?
Well, I've been involved in a few, and it varies a little bit. In the end, the party leader will obviously have to be satisfied with their manifesto. There are lots of bits of it, though, you know, in each subject area. And there are often, so for example, in the Conservative Party in 1992, there was a massive row over changes made at the printer by the director of the research department, my predecessor, Andrew Lansley, in a section about transport. Which the transport secretary hadn't agreed to. And they were still rang about this sort of 2 or 3 years later. The reason that matters is because it is less, I think, on the outcome of the election than on the conduct of government. One of the things that's important to understand about politicians is they try to do what they say they are going to do. This is exactly the opposite of conventional wisdom. And therefore, it's very important what they say they're going to do because they bind themselves into position, which they then try and implement, you know, which is the reason why, when we talked earlier about Peter intervening on this question of 0 hours contrast and trying to get the wording right at this point, he's trying to save them, I think, Peter, from pushing themselves in a position which they can't implement later, and then they'll get into a very awkward...
Or can't defend in an election campaign.
So, you know, but I think it's less that, actually, than what will actually end up happening in office. So the answer is that everybody will have a role. They'll usually be, in the case of the 97 Conservative Manifesto, it was written by a guy called Norman Blackwell, who was the head of the Prime Minister's Policy Unit. I was the director of the Conservative Research Department. I was involved in contributing because I was thought to be good at drafting, as was David Willetts, who was a Conservative minister, also, you know, a Conservative historian, author, so as to make sure that the document made some sort of sense as a theme, as a narrative. But lots of people contributed at the level of politics and at the level of policy in each of their individual areas. So there's an awful lot of work that goes on in the clearance of the manifesto. You have to start quite early in order to ensure that that happens. And I've been involved in some policy documents where that turned into, you know, quite a bit of a nightmare with people arguing about whether somebody had missed the deadline and whether they could, whether Ian Duncan Smith could include something about the Territorial Army because somebody else said he should have submitted it the day before yesterday and he'd failed to do it. You know, that sort of row takes up a remarkable amount of time.
So a manifesto is basically three different documents in one. The first is that it is a pitch to the voters to try and win their support. And for that, it needs a sort of an amount of narrative integrity that fits with your campaign narrative and some sort of banner policies, that the top things that symbolise that story you're trying to tell. It's also a way of holding together a coalition of supporters within your party at the level of your shadow cabinet, your cabinet, but also within, you know, all of the different stakeholders, the, you know, the conservative friends of science or the Labour friends of, you know, farming or whatever it might be. All these people who have pitches and ideas and they want to feel heard. And you can't get everybody's demands into the manifesto, but you can give people a sense of belonging and identity and connection to your agenda that helps you to mobilise a campaigning force. But then it's also, Stanley's mentioned, a programme for government. If you are assuming you will lose the election, then it's not very much a programme for government, and that matters a bit less for most of the Liberal Democrat manifestos that have existed. It's not really a programme for government. It's just the other two things, which is why Liberal Democrat manifestos tend to be really, really long, including so many thousands of policies. But you also have to recognise when you've published that much stuff, as Peter says, you are creating attack lines and fodder for your opponents. I saw something from the Conservative Party just yesterday, I think, about, you know, the Labour Party's made 373 announcements on energy policy and they add up to £93 squillion. You are creating attack material. And so increasingly, parties are sort of shrinking down their manifestos to improve the narrative integrity, but also to reduce the risk that you will be attacked on them. The downside of that is that it limits their ability to be a really established programme for government, assuming you get there.
The first election manifesto I ever had to wrestle with and have responsibility for presenting was in 1987. It was our first point of recovery from 1983.
The longest suicide note in history.
Indeed.
Michael Foot,
just crammed full of Michael Foot, Tony Benn, vote-losing policies. So I took a different approach to these policy statements and documents by the time I arrived at Labour Party headquarters. I had no alternative but to take all the sort of policy output of the policy department, and they were the defenders of the Labour Party Holy Grail. But I said, well, as the director of communications, though, I had responsibility for how they were presented on the page. And I would put the policy print, all the stuff, to one edge of the page, create a large white margin on the other side, and in the white margin, I put, extracted from the policy in the way that I chose, because I was the director of communications, single sentences, which were my summary of what I thought the Labour Party was saying, or rather should say. And it was the best gloss I could possibly put in that large white margin with as much of the print sort of squeezed on the other end of the page. The truth is that Polly is right. Manifestos are both campaigning documents and governing documents. In my sort of Blair Brown experience, Brown tended to see manifestos as campaigning documents, and their point was to put in dividing lines between you and your opponents, and his favourite dividing line, which actually did very well for him until 2010, was investment versus cuts, our investment versus Tory cuts. Problem is, in 2010, we'd sort of run out of money after the global financial crisis, so it made the investment hard, and the Tories were actually making a virtue of cuts, Cameron and Osborne. And it, at one level, it probably worked well for them. They were more in tune with what voters were feeling. On the other hand, some would say that it contributed to their achieving only a hung parliament rather than a majority. I'm not sure about that. Blair, on the other hand, like to see manifestos as sort of visionary future, this is what we're going to do with and to the country. And what's interesting about Blair is that in 1997, he started with his vision in this is what we want to do for the country, everything's going to get better, and as we know it did. But it was a fairly safety-first version of the future. By the time he got to 2001, you got a bit more of the flavour of the reforming Blair. By the time you got to 2005, you know, he was in sort of radical flow. He'd gone from reassurance in 1997 to sort of definitely more radical by the time he got to 2005, it being probably, as he knew, his last shout, his last sort of turn at throw of the dice before Gordon took over. But then if you think also of Thatcher, she was exactly the same. She was quite sort of reserved. All she wanted to do in 1979 was win. Yes, you got a sense that it was going to be different under Thatcher, but you didn't know how. By the time she was in her post-Falklands 1983 mode, she was firing on more cylinders. By the time she got to 1987, she was sort of full throttle Thatcher, and then, of course, famously, she blew herself up. But the point I'm making is that the longer a leader is in office, the more confident they get, the bolder they become, the more radical become their manifestos. That's, and that happened in the case of both Blair and Thatcher.
Right. So, and that's very interesting, I think, correct. And in the case of Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair, you could probably see what that journey would be, right? Where being bold would take them. What's your judgment about that with Keir Starmer? Where if he were to win a big majority at the next election, which is by no means certain, but it's also certainly not impossible. And he therefore gets more than one term and becomes more bold as he moves on. What does boldness to Keir Starmer? I know what boldness was to Tony Blair. Boldness was different to Gordon.
But the
Brown.
Point I'm making is that you didn't really see the boldness of Tony Blair until you got through a couple of elections. I think a new leader in the first instance is focused on one thing above all, and that's winning.
So what do we know about who is working on the Labour manifesto?
Oh, that is very clear. The guy who holds the pen is a young, smart guy called Rav Athwal, ex-Treasury official. I hope that doesn't upset Sharon Graham of Unite the Union too much. And he is overseen by the policy chief, who's a very interesting guy called Stuart Ingham. And he's an ex academic, very Labour, very tough-minded. I'd say he is in the realist school of Labour thinking, but very ambitious. He is the principal architect of Starmer's five missions, and he's very ambitious about what he wants a Labour Party to a Labour government to achieve. But I'd say the two things that are really important about him are very important for our other policy officials. One is he really knows his leader's mind. He's very close to Starmer. When you're speaking to Stuart Ingham, you know you're also speaking to Starmer. And secondly, he's learned from what the mistake that Theresa May made in 2017. She didn't talk to or include her cabinet in the writing of that manifesto. It was left to her two chiefs of staff. The cabinet didn't actually see the manifesto until they were packed on a bus, presented with a copy of it, an hour away from its actual launch at the beginning of the campaign to the public. No, not good. And Ingham, I think, is not going to make that mistake. He's talking all the time to shadow cabinet members. And that is the test of a policy official. Can you, with your leading politicians, help them get through the sort of labyrinthine nature of policy making and tell them how to avoid the landmines that they're going to encounter? For that, you need a very good relationship with your principal politicians. That's not how Theresa May approached it in 2017.
And yet, Danny, Rishi Sunak has got Will Tanner working on his manifesto, did help write the 2017 manifesto for Theresa May.
Yeah, I mean, he
Deputy Chief of Staff.
Certainly involved, although... you know, not the crucial draft, but I do think that was quite a big error. And, you know, my own experience was exactly as Peter outlines it. You have to work very closely with members of what was, in my case, the shadow cabinet, mainly because Norman Blackwell did dealing with the cabinet in 97. But in 2001, you have to work very closely with members of the shadow cabinet to ensure that they are on board for what are often quite small issues, which, you know, even at the level of the policy unit for an out-of-power party, you might not even know about. One thing that's important to understand is how small the policy-making group is for a party not in office. So, in fact, you know, that the research facilities are very distributed across the party. A lot of shadow cabinet ministers will have most of the knowledge of what the issues are. So it is particularly when you're out of office, it's really a dangerous thing to try to do. But I think in office, you know, as Theresa proved, taking people by surprise in politics is usually a bad idea.
So it's Will Tanner, who's Rishi Sunak's deputy chief of staff, and James Nation, the deputy head of the Number 10 policy unit, are writing the Tory manifesto. Presumably there's an enormous team, thousands of people working on a Lib Dem manifesto, probably.
Well, you have to remember there's a difference between writing, you know, not actually holding the pen these days, usually tapping on a keyboard, but and authorship of the manifesto. And, you know, in the Liberal Democrats, there is the advantage of a very extensive democratic policy process. Now, it, lots of ways, is not an advantage, but it at least means that there's just no way you could do the stunt on the bus with a manifesto in that way. There is a Federal Policy Committee, there is a manifesto working group that's chaired by Dick Newby, who's a peer, but also Ed Davey is heavily involved. But it's a very open process. It makes it almost impossible for the Liberal Democrats to announce anything new during a general election. But actually, because of the way in which they're campaigning and their kind of ground war focus in a relatively discrete number of seats, it doesn't really matter. You're just building up momentum.
But there's also the risk for the Lib Dems, the same as the Labour Party got the union sort of saying, well, we're part of the process and we want these things. The leader of the Lib Dems gets a whole load of things hung around his neck by motions passed at conference, and to what extent do you go along with them, include them, don't include? You know, Nick, they tried to drop tuition fees as a policy, but ultimately in 2010, the manifesto said we will abolish tuition fees. And it's a weird thing that the leader goes into an election with a big promise in a manifesto he personally didn't agree with because his party had said that that's what they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, that's the downside of having a democratic process. I don't actually think that. Well, it's very useful for mobilising people, for getting them to donate, to get them to be active, is to feel like the party belongs to them. Actually, the party shouldn't belong to its members. The party should belong to the voters and to the country. So, on balance, I think it's a really unhealthy way to run a political party.
I think in an election campaign, you have to realise that the media have very little interest in the manifesto. I mean, almost zero interest until and unless they can find something in it that they can detonate. I mean, they want to sort of find something they can weaponize against the party publishing the manifesto. And the truth is that the Conservative Party have two advantages. They have a Conservative Research Department, which has been trained over and honed over many decades in trawling over Labour Party documents, finding things to that can be detonated. And they do have a huge right-leaning, conservative-supporting media on their side who are very happy to amplify and multiply and go to war on these things that they want to detonate. And the Labour Party has found this time and time again, and having learned from experience, they determine not to leave unexploded ordnance littered around their manifesto for the Conservative Research Department to find. And Danny is here, sitting here, a great exemplar of somebody who is well trained to find unexploded ordnance in Labour Party policy documents.
And finally, I think actually that's a quite a creditable profession, don't you?
Because
if the ordnance hasn't exploded, you don't really want it to explode under the country. Seriously, there is a role to trying to work through, you know, if you were to ask me, one of the reasons I come into politics is to stop things that I think were stupid ideas from happening. And that's a very creditable position, particularly for someone who's, you know, conservative with either a small or a big C. So I do think critical about manifestos is that parties then try to implement them, and they can end up in a lot of trouble for doing that. Yeah. And that's, you know, the lesson of the tuition fees position, yes. The lesson of various conservative, very, I think, foolish promises about tax rates, which, you know, particular tax rates and freezing particular tax rates that have repeatedly then been beached by changing economic
There's
circumstances.
There's a terrible, terrible habit, which I've seen in the Labour Party, of letting things lie, let it be vague, just pop it into the manifesto, don't specify in any way, and it will go unnoticed during a campaign. And then, of course, it gets unearthed and detonated in front of you, and you think, oh, God, if only I had sorted this out before the campaign began, if only I'd resolved these issues, if only I'd sort of stood up to people and said, look, realistically, what are we actually proposing here? But no, quiet life, people drift into a campaign and then suddenly find that the whole campaign is turned upside down because of some piece of ordnance which is suddenly discovered.
Now, let's turn our attention to some of your questions. John, WhatsApp this message in.
Hi. I'd be interested in your thoughts of whether there's any scope for randomised selection of candidates or even for MPs. This is probably best directed at Peter initially, as he has some experience of this effectively happening in practice and being successful. I'm referring to the election of Stuart Drummond, aka Hangus the Monkey.
Peter looked thrilled to be reminded again about the... So this is a man dressed as the football the mascot for Hartlepool Football Club. It stood to become mayor of Hartlepool in 2002. Never thought for a second he'd win, and then did and beat the Labour Party in your own backyard.
You haven't said what he was dressed as.
Oh, Hangus the Monkey.
A monkey,
yeah.
So he wore every week at home and away games of the Hartlepool United this monkey costume, and he was famous for it. He was a great town's figure, really, really nice guy, had zero interest in politics or running the town's affairs. And he thought it'd be a good joke if he stood for the Hartlepool mayoral directly elected election as Hangus the Monkey. And then the joke was on us because he won.
But then he kept winning, didn't he?
He kept, well, on the night, I mean, I was absolutely heartbroken by this because it was one occasion in which we had found a really, really good Labour candidate. He was a local businessman, a real town family, Leo Gillen, and he was, we would have made a superb mayor. And he was beaten by
a monkey. How good was the monkey then as a mayor?
He wasn't very good.
He kept being elected, didn't he? Well, did he get re-elected?
No, what happened was that the really effective chief executive of the town quit. Right. He moved on. He didn't want to stick around with this nonsense. But the thing about Stuart, he was very nice and very, very well-meaning, but effective.
But what about this idea, Danny, of randomly selecting people? Okay. Like jewellery service, you'd be told, right, you're going to be an MP for the next 5 years.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's called sortition, this idea, and it's actually, you know, a theory of democracy that it'd be better to do that. You'd get more diversity.
Sortition.
Sortition, it's called.
Sounds like Harry Potter again.
Choosing like a rash. Choosing representatives by lot, effectively.
Yeah.
You'd obviously... To get pure randomness, you'd have to make it compulsory for people to accept this office. And you would get very, very wide variation. So my opinion is that the average would be lower than you would get letting people seek office, right? So there are certain disadvantages if people seek office. You get less diversity. You also get more people who are, ambitiously looking after themselves for both good and a bad way. But I would say on the whole, sortition would fare worse than people applying.
I've learnt a new word, Poppy, but do you think it's a good idea?
If you've forgotten my name,
what
though?
Did I just say?
Poppy.
Don't
know who she is, but...
It's our dog.
It's the name of my dog as well. Is your dog called
anyway,
Poppy?
Let's not mention Polly. What do you think about sortition?
Well,
as a dog's name,
I don't want to provoke Peter because we're nearly out of time. But actually, Keir Starmer has been really quite interesting. Or was it? No, it was Sue Gray talking about the role of citizens' juries as part of our assemblies. Democratic infrastructure. Assemblies. Citizens' juries, assemblies. There's different ways. And my view is that this sortition, drawing people by lot to participate in democratic processes, has a really important role to play in resolving big issues. It's much better than referendums. It was used in Ireland in the run-up to the referendum on abortion to create a much more participative, structured process for what was being put to people. There's lots of innovation in city governance around having a standing citizens' jury. My view is that you need representative democracy as well. But the two together can work effectively balance...
It went less well recently in Ireland, where the citizens' assemblies went one way and the entire Irish public went another.
Well, let's not get bogged down in citizens' assemblies again. That brings us to the end of How to Win an Election. Peter Madison, Polly McKenzie, Daniel Finkelstein, I'm Matt Jolly. On the episode next week, we'll bring you details of how you can come and see us live. That's How to Win an Election.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.